is that people do not know how to use this device. And it's not that easy for many people to understand how it works. And many of the sellers list those devices as in non-working condition. Yes, very interesting is that using the switch mode technology for low dissipation when sinking power and active low in this device, that's the necessary serious BOP, recuperate the energy for reuse. So the key is a bi-directional AC input power factor correcting circuitry, which allows the transparent energy interchange without dissipative internal sinking. It looks like when you have too much energy, it is returning this energy to the power source. Absolutely beautiful. I think Glenn, or maybe Eric also, they were having a lot to do with that, and I would love to hear their feedback about it.
I think BOP stands for Bipolar Output Power Supply, but this thing has a switching network by which it produces its voltage, and that switching network also is like the energy reclaiming that you have with an electric automobile, where you've got dynamic braking. I mean, you take an electronic, well-designed automobile, as you apply the brakes, the motors at the wheels become generators. They pump energy back into the battery to restore it so it doesn't get wasted as simple heat on your disc brake pads, if you know what I mean. So this power supply is able to take a load like solar cells that are supplying energy. It's able to take that energy and put it back into the power supply, and I guess in theory it's capable of pumping it back into Con Ed. Very exotic circuit. Glenn, are you there? I want to make some comments on this. Glenn or Eric, let's see if either one of you wants to make some comment on these bipolar output power supplies, four quadrant things. K2LIW listening.
K2QIQ.
Glenn, recognize, stand by a minute. Okay, go right ahead, Glenn. And I wonder if you've used, with your work with fancy light-emitting diode power supplies, I bet you've used some of these fancy circuits. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
No, I haven't, Dick. I am familiar with KEPCO and what they've been doing over there for years. I built a couple of these myself for, you know, different test applications of things. They, you know, I've done some switching versions of them and also some linear versions of them as well, both of which have interesting characteristics to them. But I think there's a lot of detail here, but maybe if you have some questions or somebody has some questions about them, I'm better off you know, addressing them. But you know, I wouldn't know where to start. K2QIQ.
I believe John would analyze the circuitry with John, and John will have a few words about it.
Yeah, what we're discussing here is a kind of a power supply-like thing, which you can adjust it for the constant output voltage characteristic or constant output current characteristic, depending on how you set it up. It's capable of doing that, and it will supply positive voltage, negative voltage. You can control that with a command voltage, and it's a great big op-amp, so to speak, that amplifies whatever you give into it, and it gives you a lot more power output and a lot more voltage output, but it operates in a bi-directional manner, not only in polarity, but in current. So if your circuit, like photocells or photovoltaics, are supplying power, this thing will take it. Ordinarily, a power supply, if you pump the same polarity of voltage back into it, the power supply with its diode rectifiers becomes an open circuit, and nothing is controlled anymore. Ordinary power supplies. This KEPCO bipolar output power thing, this BOP thing, P-O-P, will take voltage and current in any polarity, and if you command it in the constant voltage mode, that for this period of time you want it to go to plus 30 volts, and for the next period of time you want it to go to minus 30 volts, it will do that whether the load is supplying current or sinking current, it'll still do exactly what you command. It doesn't care about current polarity. It controls the whole thing with a very fancy switching network. There's a lot of smarts in these things. It's a very useful circuit. I'm amazed that the electrical engineering schools do not cover this subject, and therefore some very smart electrical engineers operate without this knowledge and at times get themselves in a lot of trouble. This KEPCO thing would be solving a lot of their problems for it. I think you've got some opinions on this one, John. I bet you own a few of these, if I know you. KC2QIQ. Here we go. KC2WGV. K2RIW. You got it, John.
KC2WGV. No, that's one thing I don't own. I looked at the diagram of that very interesting circuit, and I was interrupted here by a visitor. In fact, Matt, KC2YDT, was just here to pick up a package, so I missed some of the conversation. But no, I don't have one of those things.
Another comment. I have three of them, and the reason that I have three of them is because it costs pennies. Most of the people do not know what is it for. The OPS version differs from BOP version only with one single element. The BOP version has built-in meters. It does have a voltage control. It does have a current control. We've been analyzing with John OPS version, so if John could say a few words about that.
You got it, John. And start off with telling us what OPS stands for.
Operational power supply, I believe. Now, from what I've seen, the smaller unit, which is the 500-volt unit, can be operated as a unipolar or a bipolar supply. It depends on the command you give it. And it also, if you look at the diagrams, you will see the input resistors and the voltage dividers that you must establish before you can use it at a specific rating you want. Now, actually, what I'm worried about is he's back in the same situation he was before. This device will only manage 40 milliamperes, and he was looking to drive Glenn's transformer with that, which is not going to happen according to what Glenn is telling me about the saturation characteristic of that transformer. So, useful toy, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, KEPCO has various models of various current and voltage, and some of them will put out 1,000 watts. OPS, I think, stands for operational power supply. In other words, it acts like an operational amplifier, but it has the power output of a power supply, and you can command it to give you predictable voltages, predictable currents, of either polarity, sourcing or sinking. Very useful circuit as I see it. As I gave a quick read of the data sheet that Wesley had me look at, I see that some of the versions are only good up to frequencies like 2 kilohertz. There are other versions that go to higher frequencies. So maybe Glenn is not familiar with these exact ones, and whether or not the one that Wesley owns now can supply the current to feed his particular network is left to be discovered. I think it's a lot more than a useful toy, if you know what I mean, John. It may not supply the exact amount of current, but since it supplies the waveform, now with the very simple power FET transistors added after this, this would be the driving circuit, and then a very simple set of power FET transistors can multiply that to the higher amounts of current that we've been talking about. So I think Wesley might have a fairly simple solution by going down this road. The only slight thing I worry about is my first reading of the data sheet led me to believe it only goes to 2 kilohertz in some of the versions.
Those versions that I have operate over 100 kilohertz, so it's perfectly good. Some of them to 500.
Linear versions, Dick, go to much higher frequencies than the switching versions.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. Because the switching version had to use some kind of a switching carrier rate, probably 100 or 200 kilohertz.
Yeah, they have a Nyquist limit.
Yeah, they probably use a switching rate of, 100 or 200 kilohertz, and therefore they got to go to a much lower power output frequency. The linear version, I'm guessing, can't produce as much current, can't produce as much power, but now can go to much higher frequency. So the trade-off is what's the highest frequency you want to go to, or what's the greatest amount of power you want to go to, or whether or not you want to have energy recovery. Is that the sort of a trade-off, depending on which model number you choose, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW, at the second end?
Yeah, basically, but here's a nice little dirty secret for a lot of people that are interested in this kind of circuit. If you were to take a bridged audio amplifier, it does the same exact thing, except that basically you just have a single input, because realistically, a linear version is nothing more than just that. In other words, if you were to have a bridged amplifier and basically you have, a plus source across the, across an amplifier on the left-hand side and one on the right-hand side, and you're basically placing the load between the two amplifier circuits, where one is being driven high and one is being driven low. So if you have the load output of a bridged amplifier, basically you've got the same exact circuit, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, but there's a couple of catches, Glenn. A bridge amplifier, H-bridge or half-bridge hi-fi amplifier can supply lots of current and lots of voltage. That's the good news. But it's a nearly constant current voltage circuit with one particular fixed gain. This operational power supply thing, by way of you setting the right feedback resistors, you can make the gain higher and lower. You can even make the gain less than unity if you want. And you can then operate it in the constant voltage mode or the constant current mode. So you can make it automatically current limit at very specific values. Your hi-fi output circuit might not have that capability. Also, your hi-fi output circuit, by way of its damping function, its built-in negative feedback, gives you a lot more limiting on what you can do with it. I think this KEPCO thing has got a lot more adaptability. Am I being too optimistic on this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Well, I think what happens, you'll find out that the they're kind of power limited. They are kind of limited in frequency. Most of these things are really designed to test very, very low frequency kind of loading. I've had some, some applications where I wanted things to operate at frequencies, much, much higher than, 2 or 3 kilohertz. I wanted to operate, closer to 100 kilohertz. What I found out was that mobile audio amplifiers, a lot of them have bridged outputs. And what I was able to do is to create the current limiting control and the voltage limiting controls with very, very small modifications to the audio amplifiers. So when I feed my signal in, I could just take a very, very simple bridged mobile audio amplifier, run it off to 12 volts, and basically be able to control the bridged output with, controlling it with a small op-amp circuit in the front that both sends the current in four quadrants, and I can adjust the voltage across the bridge. And of course, have a gain control as well. So this way I would have gain control, voltage control across the bridge, and having a small current sense resistor, low impedance current sense resistor coming back to an op-amp, I can control the current very, very linearly. So the linear versions are not that difficult to really do with just a simple audio amplifier, but a bridged audio amplifier. But not a half-bridge, because you don't have the other half of the null. Would you need the two amps? Let me let this drop for a second. To truly have a full four-quadrant power supply, you really need the bridge on both sides, so you can't really use a half bridge because you can't achieve 0 volts. In other words, if one side is ground and you pull it down to ground, you can never, you're always a diode drop away from ground. With a true four quadrant, you can actually draw some pretty darn close voltages into fractions of a volt and still have some reasonable current. So you really do need the full bridge. But the KEPCO supplies are good, provided you're just doing low frequency work, especially from a few hundred hertz and lower. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I got a further question for you, Glenn. Let's assume that Wes does own the one that goes to 100 KC. It's analog, not switching type. And it goes to 100 KC, goes to the voltage he wants, but it can only supply 40 milliamps, worst case. And if he uses that to drive the bases of those FET transistors, the the bipolar, not bipolar is not the right word, bipolarity. If he uses a pull-up and pull-down high-power FET transistor as emitter follower, as the power generator, and uses the KEPCO to power that, those base circuits, and this is those high-power FETs that you were giving him schematics of, if he then uses this to drive those transistors, isn't he now capable of doing almost everything he wants? He can get the current he wants, he gets the voltage he wants, he's got the gain control, the current feedback, he can do all kinds of things. So if he adds those two extra transistors that you've advocated, doesn't that bring him pretty close to what he's looking for? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
It would still be the isolation of the drive transformer. That's the one thing I still love, Wesley, because the floating voltage on the amplifier bridge is isolated by some pretty high voltages, and the amplifier has to drive actually four transistors in order to drive the transformer, so the isolation is still a requirement there.
Let's assume that the case of the KEPCO is grounded. Let's assume that one of the output leads of the KEPCO is grounded, and the remaining lead is capable of swinging plus 1,000 and minus 1,000. Let's assume that. And it's only got 40 milliamps of capability, but it's got 100 kc of capability. And then it's driving a pair of high-power FET transistors as a complementary symmetry circuit. They're being used as an emitter follower. The upper transistor is going to a plus 1,000-volt power supply in my diagram. The bottom transistor is going to a minus 1,000-volt power supply. The output of that emitter follower, the complementary symmetry emitter follower, is now driving his transformer, and the KEPCO is sitting at ground. Wouldn't that be a safe operating procedure to get what he desires? Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Yeah, it could, but there again, he would need, you know, linear transistors to do that, and also the split power supplies to do that as well.
But those super moosey, really beefy transistors that you told him he can use that are not too expensive, and he already owns a plus 500 and a minus 500 power supply that can feed them, I think he's got the raw ingredients to do that. And now the KEPCO and all its circuitry doesn't have to be floating. The load doesn't have to be floating. I mean, one end of the load is going to be grounded. One end is going back to this complementary symmetry high-power emitter-follower thing. I think that is one possible approach. What do you see as the fallback, or what do you see as the danger of that particular approach? What part of that do you think might not work as well as we desire, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
I'm sorry, I have one that is 500 volts plus minus, and the other one is 1,000 volts, and the other one is 1,000 volts plus minus.
Yeah, what's wrong with that scenario that I just drew, Glenn? Where would he get in trouble with the somewhat simplified schematic I just described? You got it, Glenn.
Well, the gates are isolated. In other words, there you have four gates to drive. Two gates have to be on at the same time. The alternating gates have to be on the bridge and on one side, and the two alternating have to be on the other side. The problem with the gates are that they're basically 500 volts apart. So in other words, you have you need four signals. In other words, you need the signal to drive the top MOSFET on, the bottom one off, and on the opposite side, on the opposite bridge, on the other half of the bridge, you'd have to drive the top one low and the bottom one high. So they're alternating, so you need four signals. I don't see the signals there.
I think you've misunderstood me, Glenn. You've jumped back to a full H bridge. I'm talking about a half bridge, two complementary symmetry transistors only. One complementary symmetry, and both of them being used, connected together, source to source. One drain goes up to plus 500 volts. One drain goes down to minus 500 volts in my diagram, and each of those power supplies are properly grounded. Now they're being connected together, source to source, as an emitter follower. The two gates are almost connected together, except for some biases, back to the KEPCO, so that this half bridge with two separate power supplies, one positive and one negative, the whole circuit is a half bridge emitter follower. Can't the KEPCO fire that emitter follower thing as a half bridge and give him the bipolar output voltage he's looking for. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I still don't think so. I don't see it because you still have to control the saturation voltage of the FETs. In other words, you'd have to control those FETs from 0 to 15 volts, and they're going to still be, you know, 500 volts isolated. How do you maintain that as those power supplies are swinging 500 volts, that they're always maintaining that the transistors are in saturation in and out? I don't see it, Vic.
I'm pretty sure you're misunderstanding me again, Glenn. I haven't made it clear. If the transistor, let's just talk about one single transistor, just to be simple, with running from a positive power supply on its drain. It's being used as an emitter follower. Let's call it a source follower. Yes, it's a source follower. It's being used as a source follower. As I change the voltage on the gate of that source follower, doesn't the source tend to follow me, voltage for voltage, not counting the bias offset? So now if I've got a pair of complementary symmetry FET transistors connected together, source to source, the gates, except for some biases, offset biases, are connected together, gates to gates, and the gates are being fed by the KEPCO. Now that whole network is a bipolar source follower. Each volt I put into the gates is almost the exact same number of volts coming out of the source, yes, which is the load. Doesn't that follow the KEPCO except for some offsets? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm not following you, Dick. I'm missing. So you'd have to draw it to me and send it to me in an email or something, because something doesn't make sense here. In other words, those gates have to be maintained 0 to 15 max, and the source, you're saying it's connected to the load, and then you're talking about connecting the KEPCOs to the source, but the KEPCO is current limited. So I'm missing a whole bunch of things here in the picture, Dick.
It's current limited or voltage limited.
Dick? Stand by, fellas. I'm going to try one more time. Glenn, let's go back to bipolar transistors, emitter follower. The emitter goes to the load. The collector goes up to the B-plus on this NPN transistor. And I'm putting a AC voltage on the base. As I move that base voltage up and down, the emitter follower follows with 7/10 of a volt offset at all times. There's never more or less than approximately 7/10 of a volt from emitter to base. As I change the voltage on the emitter, as I change the voltage on the base, the emitter, which is connected to the load, follows me. That's an emitter follower. Can I do that with FET transistors? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, you have to remember that the enhancement mode of those TMOS type MOSFETs are not very, very linear, as the emitter follower would be. Basically, what will happen is if you create something like, if you were to put a Zener diode across the, from the gate to the source connection, and then you were to drive it, and always ensure that the KEPCO would always be at least 15 volts above the 500 volts max of the, the drain supply. So in other words, you need have to make sure that the KEPCO can go at least, if you're running the drain at 500, you have to make sure that the KEPCO goes up at least to 15 volts greater, and you have something there like a Zener diode to make sure that the from drain to source that voltage on the gate doesn't exceed the drain, if you follow what I'm saying, in the saturation condition. Do you follow me now, Ben?
Yes, I think I do. You're talking about the dangers at the limits of performance, where I go to the maximum voltage output, and I might be back-biasing things and whatever, and the 15-volt offset for the enhancement mode, or 7-volt offset for the enhancement mode. But in the case of an emitter follower, the transistor itself could be fairly nonlinear, but an emitter follower has the world's highest feedback ratio. The emitter base voltage, or emitter base current, is what turns the transistor on and off. If the emitter of an emitter follower, I'm talking back now to bipolar, is connected to the load. The emitter goes to the load. The collector goes to B+. The base goes to the source of signal. Even though that transistor may be nonlinear as all hell, it's got the ultimate in feedback. That emitter follower is going to follow the input voltage, volt for volt, except for the 7/10 offset. And all of that nonlinearity of the transistor is a... What's wrong with an emitter follower following me and giving me high linearity? Before we go over to the FET, would an emitter follower give me high linearity? Yes or no?
Yes, it will. But that's the problem. Right now, let's say it's a 500-volt power supply, and he's got a magnetization current of somewhere around half an amp, 500 milliamps. So 500 milliamps with 250 volts, let's say it's halfway up in a nice linear region, 250 volts at 500 milliamps, I think you're starting to see the power problem here. K2IW, KC2QIQ, that's a very big heat sink. Those transistors are going to go on fire.
Oh, I'm going to agree with you on that. However, if he needs a circuit that takes his KEPCO output that in theory produces the right waveform, but only 40 milliamps, the right frequency, the right waveform, and now he goes into a high enough power set of complementary symmetry FET transistors of high enough power dissipation, and maybe he's got to put five of them in parallel going up to the positive and five of them in parallel going down to the negative, and great big heat sinks on all of them. Those are the details. And yes, because the enhancement mode requires some number of significant volts of offset, 7 or 15 volts of offset. And by the way, you bias the gate on the positive going FET and the way you bias the gate on the negative going FET, the right kind of zeners and offset voltages and pull-up resistors, yeah, those are the minor details. But once it is an emitter follower, which in this case is going to be complementary source follower, let's not worry about the dissipation yet, but even though it's a source follower similar to an emitter follower, even though the transistors may be nonlinear as all hell when I use it as a grounded source device, but I'm using this as an emitter follower, that built-in feedback mechanism forces a tremendous amount of linearity. If you get that linearity out of an emitter follower with bipolars, you're telling me I can't get it out of a source follower with FET? Why not? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Now, I'll repeat that again, Dick. You didn't hear me. I said, yes, it would be linear, but I said that was the problem. The linearity is a dissipation problem. That's exactly what I said.
I think you and I are on the same page. What you're saying is that because it's a linear, non-switching circuit, every bit of the current voltage drop across the transistor represents real dissipation. And how many kilowatts of dissipation we got to worry about? Yes, those are details, without a doubt. And can we eventually flip this over to a switching mode emitter follower instead of a linear mode emitter follower? Those are some more of the details downrange. But at least that beautiful high-power FET transistor circuit that you sent us as a schematic a week or two ago, I think it's a beginning of a solution to what he's looking for. We've got to worry about the details of dissipation, how many transistors in parallel, how big a heat sink, do we use it in the linear mode or the switching mode? Those are the details. But I think this KEPCO could be the source of the signal that's either voltage limited or current limited. By way of its built-in feedback mechanisms, you can take the output current or output voltage of this overall network, feed it back for protection purposes, and have the KEPCO do the limitation of the instantaneous dissipation, instantaneous current, and whatever. I think there's all kinds of capability here if we become smart enough. Maybe I'm being a little bit too naive here. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, the philosophy of that circuit that I drew for Wesley was strictly to run it in saturation, to really switch it and switch it hard. And the idea there is that, you know, in the switching case, you have very, very low dissipation on the power MOSFET. And driving the transformer, because he needed a drive of about a kilowatt, you know, it's initially he had a power supply that he thought would give him the kilowatt, you know, kilovolt of voltage and be able to supply, you know, enough current to drive the transformer. But just to get past the magnetization current at a kilovolt square wave, that machine, you know, gave up the ghost somewhere around a few hundred milliamps. and he just couldn't drive it anymore, and they just ran out of guts and went into full. So the idea behind MOSFETs was to create a switch that would switch hard to an external power supply and then be able to have a gate drive circuit that would switch it with a signal generator. And in this way, he could at least get the pulses that he needed to drive the transformer and get the spark pulses that he was looking for. But to do a full linear, like sine wave, let's drop for a second. But to do a full linear amplification stage where you're doing sine waves, and, you know, triangle waves, all different kinds of multi-waveform function generator type functions, the dissipation there is going to be huge. The transformer will hack it, no problem, but the amount of lab-style amplification at that level, that's going to be a very, very difficult project, and I think it might be going way beyond the scope of what Wesley's trying to do. K2RI is at the KC2QIQ.
Okay, now I've got an alternate approach, Glenn, and I think I'm getting back into, you've jumped ahead a couple of steps, and you saw something that I didn't see yet, and I'm starting to beginning to see it. Let's assume that his KEPCO does have 100 kilohertz capability, and let's be a little bit naive at first and assume it can make a somewhat clean 100 kilohertz square wave. I know it's a bunch of jumps there, but let's assume it can do that.
120 kilohertz whole linearity.
So let's assume that it can make a almost clean-looking square wave at 100 kilohertz. And if we use that in the switching mode, where he really wants to make a sine wave or somewhat quasi-sine wave, let me pick a number, 10 kilohertz, where he's got a 10-to-1 ratio now between the switching rate and the actual audio waveform that he's producing, and it's pulse width modulated. So now the switching FET transistors are running in the saturated mode, full square wave, fed by the KEPCO. They've got a plus 500 and a minus 500 power supply feeding them. And now, except for the offset and saturation characteristics and some careful circuitry there, could that now be a much lower dissipation power generating circuit running in the switch mode, giving him, let's say, a 10 kilohertz sine wave for my particular example? Is that by pulse width modulation, is that a possible viable approach that you see, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Well, provided they can move that fast, and the other thing, too, is that you're not really sure how much current, the gates are going to really draw. I mean, to snap a gate on at 100 kilohertz, you're going to need, 100 nanosecond rise times on those gates. To get a nice, nice square waveform. That peak current, into a 10 nanofarad gate to source capacitance could be a couple of amps. And I'm not sure that KEPCO is going to be up to the job to do that. One of the reasons for creating a second stage of transistors that were a little bit pretty heavy duty too, to run up a 12 volts power supply with an isolation transformer, was that he would get four individual pulse signals that could deliver amps to those gates and really snap them on at 100 nanoseconds and make sure that those transistors were really saturated. KEPCO will do a nice square waveform, but will it have the current with the voltage? I don't think it will, Vic.
Yeah, I see another problem, and maybe there's a solution to it. If he's running a simple half bridge in the way I've described it, grounded KEPCO, positive supply on the positive going FET, negative supply on the negative going FET, and they're being connected together as source followers. And now to put a square wave into those gates and to do it in nanoseconds and switching 500 volts up, 500 volts down, 1,000 volts peak to peak, and now you're running into a DVDT problem. I don't think KEPCO and the transistors can really follow that DVDT. If we switch over and now run the high power FET transistors as grounded source mode, and by some kind of magic, the positive going FET pulls the output voltage from plus 500 down to ground, the negative going FET pulls the voltage from negative 500 volts down to ground, and they're both running grounded source mode. And now the voltage swing that you require on the gates is a hell of a lot smaller, and with the DVDT limitations of the KEPCO, let me drop... you now stand a greater chance of being able to produce the right command waveform to power those FETs. And the FETs better be good for more than 1,000 volt capability, even though they've got a 500 volt power supply, because when the positive FET up top is allowing the voltage to go to plus 500, the bottom FET is seeing the wrong polarity. I can see now why you're going over to an H bridge.
It is 200 microseconds rise and fall down.
Yeah, well, 200 microseconds is a quarter of a millisecond, and you're not going to get a very clean 100 kc square wave out of that. So we're running into some DVDT timing problems, but I can see now why you're advocating a pure H bridge. The pure H bridge stands more of a chance of doing it, but now you need floating transformers or light emitting diode circuits to feed it, and when you're using pulse width modulation on isolating transformers that are feeding the individual FETs, life is going to get a lot more complicated. You have to use transformers that can really go down to the
transformer deck.
You have to use transformers that go down to the baseband rate. If you want to operate it at 10 kilohertz, then those transformers have to have full capability of 10 kilohertz. So you are doing it with isolation transformers on the four transistors of the H-bridge. Is that the possible way of doing it, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Yeah, exactly. It's really one drive transformer, and we're all... five windings are basically all coupled directly together. It's like a pentaphile transformer where basically all five wires are wound exactly at the same time, the same number of turns around a toroidal core. And basically what's really going on there is that I'm using two more transistors running off of a 12-volt power supply basically that are being switched with comparators. So the comparators can basically switch at low signal level, 0 to 12 volts, and then basically push-pull the drive transformer, and then the drive transformer basically has the isolation across the 500 volts and gives the correct polarity to each one of the four transistors in the H-bridge. So as each one is turning on and turning off, they basically have the drive transformer commanding the gates. So it's the safest way to drive the gates of the H-bridge, and it's basically controlled by a single input source. So by putting in a command signal to the comparators, you can drive those driving MOSFETs on and off and to drive the drive transformer, and then you get very, very nice, fast, square wave driving transformers. That's why those transistors are as heavy duty as they look like. They probably are bigger than they should be, but they are the right size. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Fantastic. Now I remember that schematic that you drew 1 or 2 weeks ago. Now I see the magic of that. And it's an H-bridge, one fancy transformer with five windings. Everything is now all coherent in timing, all coherent in voltages, the right polarities, the right offsets, the right floating on the four output windings that are firing the four gates of the four transistors of the H-bridge. Okay. Do you believe that circuit, as you drew it, Glenn, would operate at a switching rate of 100 kc? Maybe the answer is no. If you want to operate it in a switch mode, what do you believe is the highest frequency switch mode that circuit that you drew is capable of operating without running into a problem? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
I'm going to take a guess on this one, but I would imagine that what's going to happen is the transformer has got pretty good coupling. And what will happen is as the frequency goes higher, the magnetization current is going to go down. So that's kind of a little bit of magic there. So actually the load gets easier as the frequency goes up. The other thing is the gate capacitance becomes a little bit harder to drive, but I put a nice healthy drive on that. So that should be able to take care of that. I would take a random guess that circuit will probably work to quite a few megahertz. And the tougher nut is going to be the lower frequency. At low frequency, the drive transformer eventually is just going to lose, there'll be too much droop in the drive waveform. In other words, to try to hold up long pulses beyond 100 microseconds of on time, that's probably where it's going to give up the ghost, if you know what I mean.
I would like to make some correction. I look at the wrong data. It's a 66 microseconds rise and fall time, and recovery is 190 microseconds.
You know, with those rise and fall times, and that's probably rated for full voltage output, Wes, you're going to be using a lot less than full voltage output. Therefore, potentially, if it's a DVDT limitation problem, you're going to have an apparent rise time that might be quite a bit faster than that. In order to turn these FETs fully on and off by way of this transformer coupling network with five windings that you talked about, Glenn, roughly how many volts peak to peak on the gates of the transistors are required for full on to full off? That tells us how much magnetization at what lower frequency the transformer has to tolerate. Is it like a 10-volt swing that's required on the gates to give them full on to full off, KC2 QIQ, K2 RIW?
Yeah, a typical CMOS structure, enhancement gate MOSFET, will basically gauge the source voltage somewhere around 3 volts, 2.5 to 3 volts. The drain to source will start to conduct. And what will happen is it'll be nicely, hardly saturated somewhere around 8 to 12 volts. So a nice 12-volt source on that drive, basically going 0 to 12 volts, there's very, very hard saturation. So basically, zero, they're off. And then basically, one of the nice features of the symmetrical drive transformers, those gate signals will not only go from 12 volts, they'll go to minus 12 volts. And although they'll be completely off at zero, being held down at minus 12 volts, and the transistor can safely withstand a minus 30 volt gate voltage, they're well within their range and will go in and out of saturation very, very nicely.
Dick, with your permission, I have one more subject. We have 14 minutes left, and I believe that would be interesting to the audience. In point 5, there was a lightning in extreme slow motion which shows upward lightning. And I have a series of videos. I wonder if you had a chance to go through that.
Let me ask Glenn one more question. Glenn, if I'm producing plus 10 volts to turn the transistor on, minus 10 volts during the off mode, I'm now producing a 20-volt peak-to-peak square wave switching mode to operate these transistors. And if I wanted to go down to a sine wave of, let's say, 10 kilohertz, so I want to produce a 10 kilohertz sine wave by way of 100 kilohertz switching mode, 20 volts peak-to-peak. Is that a whole lot of iron, or is that a reasonable amount of iron that would do that? That's the last question on this one. KC2 QIQ, K2 RIW.
There we go. Actually, it's not that big at all. It's ferrite. And in other words, we're somewhere around the area of around 500 microhenries. And the magic there is that the transformer will basically, because it's going plus and minus, is always resetting itself on each cycle. The only real problem with the lower frequency end is that even with, like, say, 500 microhenries of inductance on each one of the windings, is that as you get to lower and lower frequency, the magnetization current starts swamping whatever the supply current is coming out of the 12-volt source, and you'll start seeing pulse droops. So what will happen is you'll start off at 10 or 12 volts, and it'll probably start drooping down to, like, 8 volts. So eventually what will happen is as you go to lower and lower frequencies, you just naturally what will happen is you won't the pulse won't be able to extend anymore. It'll just basically droop right off like a self current limiting kind of circuit.
Yeah, and I think there's ways around that. Okay, in the case of lightning, the majority of clouds are, I think, negatively charged. I may have it backwards. But some small percentage of the time, the cloud charges itself with the opposite polarity. Yeah, I think it's a negative is the usual. If a cloud happens to be positively charged at the bottom, which is the rare case, Those are the lightning bolts that are about 10 times stronger, very loud, very destructive, very dangerous. And now, the way the leader strokes occur, before the lightning strike really happens, there's a whole lot of events in the microseconds ahead of time by which individual cosmic rays are drawing out the path, ionizing the path for you. And so, ordinarily, a lightning from a negative charge cloud, the lightning, all of its leader strikes and the actual main stroke that occurs, you take a time-lapse photograph of that, and all of those individual leaders look like an upside-down tree, and some of the branches of the tree never reach to the ground. That's a negative cloud. You get the opposite polarity of the tree, the opposite polarity of the leaders in some cases, opposite polarity of which way the actual lightning bolt, the main charge when it comes through, does it go from cloud to ground or ground to cloud? So because lightning has got various polarities, boy, you can get some crazy effects along those lines. No, I haven't seen that particular email yet, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
There is a set of three videos that shows the lightning that goes in slow motion with a fast recording camera of 300 pictures per second, and it is showing 3,000 pictures per second, and it is showing a lightning that is going from the bottom to very top. Also, another subject that I have brought to the attention was Pfaff and Feinberg multiplier. Amazing, absolutely amazing. There are two capacitors, and you simply touch with your finger to the two sides of one capacitor. It's a movie, but it is also, when you go all the way to the down, there's Pfaff and Feinberg multiplier, where only by touching with your finger, you're building the charge. And the other capacitor that is connected to that is you simply pick up and one of the plates of the capacitor and lower it down. By that, you're starting from zero, building the charge to hundreds of thousands of volts. Back to you.
N2LDY, go ahead with your question or comment, sir.
I just wanted to mention to you that I did send off a couple of emails to you, so when you get a chance, you can look at that.
John, you sent them to me how long ago?
An hour ago, right after we spoke.
Okay, and the emails you sent to me, what is the sender address?
You know, I might not have included something in the first one, but I sent it to the KCQRIWSEARRL email address.
Is it entitled, here are some photos of the Doppler project? Is that the email?
Yeah, that's one of them. That was one of them. That was the PC port I was making. I'm making the Doppler, and I was running the first set of ports, as a test, to prove out the circuit.
Yeah, we may not be able to discuss that yet tonight, Don. You're giving this to me at the 11th hour, so to speak. Hey, you shipped that at 10:10 p.m., and so we may not be able to discuss that tonight. It's a change of subject, but we certainly can pick it up next week. Now, the email that you're talking about that you sent to me, Wes, what is the time at which this email was sent so I know which one to look for? Go ahead.
That's the same email that contains all of the links for the TechNet, and it was sent today about 7:30 p.m. 6:33 p.m., 5 hours ago. And it says approved for the publication. It does have all of the links for the KEPCO power supplies, and then at the bottom of it, point number 5 has 3 YouTube videos that shows upward lightning, and then the next one to the very bottom, before the picture of the Farnsworth patent, which we're not going to discuss today, we don't have a time, is Pfaff and Svanberg multiplier. And then when you lose the, click on the link www.coe.ufrgbr, and then you're going to see that material showing a pictures of that, but then there is a video in it that will show how he does it. It is a very short video, probably 1 minute, but it shows it beautifully.
Yeah, I see that particular website. Beautiful looking circuit. Pfaff and Svanberg multiplier. The very first picture looks like two pancake-shaped metallic objects with rods coming out of the top. So this is a voltage multiplier circuit. It might have some of the characteristics of a Cockcroft-Walton voltage multiplier. And so this thing is capable of making a whole lot of kilovolts. In the video picture I see at the bottom, I haven't played that video yet, I see something that looks like a spark gap sitting on the table. Is that what I'm looking at, Wes? Go ahead.
There's no spark gap. If you just click on that video, it's going to show what he's doing. With one hand, he's picking up one plate of the capacitor. The capacitors are connected in series. At the bottom, you have electro... John, how do you call that device at the bottom with the two bolts?
What, the electroscope?
Oh, right.
Yes, like an electroscope with two pith poles in it, yes.
You see that by simply touching your finger to one plate, to one capacitor, plate bottom and plate top, plate bottom and plate top, in the very much very much set fashion, you are building the charge. The video is only 1 minute probably, and it is gonna show you those two small balls showing extremely high voltage. If you want to move fast, you just go to at the beginning and go to the end of it, and then he's gonna show that he takes two plates of the capacitor from the top out, and the amazing voltage is there.
That whole effect is called the electrophoresis effect, or the influence machine effect. That's a well-known phenomenon that has been around for almost 200 years. They used to do it with a piece of, what did they call it? No, it wasn't paraffin. It was a fancy kind of a wax-like material on a plate. And if you use it correctly, and I think you charged it by rubbing it with wool, and then by touching and moving this plate, you can build up some very high voltages. Electrophoresis is what it's called. Believe it or not, that principle of operation is how a Wimhurst machine works. So he's got a two-element Wimhurst machine by which he's lifting and lowering those plates and touching them at the right time, very similar to the four sets of brushes that are on a Wimhurst machine. I wonder if you've seen that relationship, John, now that you and I both own a Wimhurst machine. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Absolutely, Dick. I saw that effect. And all he's doing is transferring or collecting charges, as you see as he's moving his finger. That's all that's happening there. Same as the Wimhurst machine. Absolutely.
The interesting in it is that he didn't wrap the fingers before. He's using a mechanical force of his hand on one capacitor and touching the finger in very much orderly fashion. And that fashion is being shown as a sequence right above the picture of the video. It is shown exactly what he's doing. black Q and A and C and D. Do you see that?
Yes, I think I do. One of the things that's well-kept secret that a lot of people don't realize is that the so-called tribal electric effect, in other words, when you bring different materials together, like a piece of wool and a piece of glass or Teflon or whatever, you bring them together, everyone thinks that to make an electrostatic charge requires rubbing. Not necessarily. Just bringing things together and bringing them apart creates a transfer of charge depending on the two materials that are interfacing with each other. Rubbing will increase the effect, but rubbing is not necessarily required. He's just lifting and lowering those plates like the so-called electrophoresis effect, and he doesn't have to do any rubbing. So a lot of people don't know that, that when you peel a piece of scotch tape, for instance, off of the roll, you're making some very high voltages when you do that, and it doesn't require rubbing to do it. And you actually measure the voltage that you get of peeling off a piece of scotch tape, and I think it approaches numbers like 10,000 volts. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Thank you very much for the beautiful session to you, to Glenn, and to Eric, and to others listening to it. We are approaching the time of end of the internet. I'm returning the mic to Glenn, Dick.
You guys, in case we get cut off at midnight, like I think we're going to, when the machine automatically does that, this was TechNet number 1,383 of the series that began in September of 1982. And we did give lots of web addresses tonight by which people can get all kinds of information on moonbounds, directional couplers. By the way, that Roadrunners Microwave Group doesn't have just the article on by K2RIW on directional couplers. It has 9 other articles about antennas and antenna effective capture area and their scattering area and all kinds of other things there about the magic of a PL259 connector that people say such bad things about. There's 9 other articles there that some people are interested in. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. Be kind to each other. We'll be back next week and dig more into these subjects, it says here. K2RIW, TechNet Limark. Over to you, John. KC2WGB. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. I'm not going to wait for it to be. Great job tonight, Dick. Good net. And thank you for your time. Pass it on to Glenn if he's still out there.
And John, thank you very much for a beautiful job that you're doing too. Can you move upstairs?
The time is 12:01 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2BL repeater.
Where are you, T?
Good morning. The time is 12:01 a.m. 12:01 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2BL repeater.
Good night, Bestley.
Disconnected. 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 Disconnected.